to be involved in the pursuit of agriculture. Prior to World War II, agriculture was characterized by a sense of independence and a sense of self-reliance. The picture, if we could paint a picture of the typical American farm, all the way from the Skagit valleys of western Washington State through the Midwest, all the way to the Northeast, we would find that the typical American farm before World War II relied almost entirely on animal power. Small dairies were common, herd sizes from about 10 to 15 animals. Chickens, hogs, and cattle could all be found on those same small farms. And it was not uncommon to find a small orchard and a very large garden. And the pillars of that cropping system relied quite heavily on crop rotation. Fertility on the farm was managed through the resources from that given farm, through recycling animal wastes and through green manuring. And these were family-owned and often intergenerational enterprises. And this is the pillar of Jeffersonian democracy and the Homesteading Act, of which I am a product, and I'm guessing many of you are as well. My grandparents homesteaded along the Missouri Breaks, along the Missouri River in north central North Dakota in 1917. Some of the last homesteading to take place in the continent took place in the 1917-1920s. And those ranches have remained in the family and have remained fairly diverse, but they are subject to some of the same peril that we're facing in agriculture across the country today. And so I thought we would start this weekend with a slideshow. And this slideshow has been put together by a friend of ours, Ron Cruz. Ron Cruz, for the past 10 years, he was the founder and the director of an organization in Minnesota called the Land Stewardship Project. And just out of curiosity, has anybody heard of the Land Stewardship Project? Fairly present organization, in particular in the Northwest or in the Midwest. As Ron worked closely with farmers to begin to take a look at some of their reliance upon chemical inputs on their farms, he began to find that there was a psyche around the use of agricultural chemicals. And he set out to try and find the source of that. Where did that come from? Where did that fear and that anger come from? And this understanding that nature was an enemy. And so he began to look at some of the sweeping changes that took place in American agriculture immediately following World War II. And it's interesting that American agriculture was already the envy of the world. We were the only country on the planet that consistently had crop surpluses instead of crop shortages. We had set up an agricultural system in this country built upon independence and upon local marketing and upon regional marketing and upon diversity. And that began to change quite rapidly after the war. And so Ron has named this slideshow Disarming Farming, the relationship between the military-industrial complex and American agriculture. And so on his behalf, I bring this presentation to you. And I bring it to you with a plea. It is time for those of us that espouse peace and justice begin to look at the need for peace in our agriculture and peace in our relationship with the land. For after World War II, when victory was won, the guns and bombs of that war were turned upon our own land. And they were turned upon that land and its people in ways that you will see in the slideshow that I'm about to show you. But I want to be careful. I want to be careful here because we have the luxury of hindsight. And we can look back, and the thing that we have to be cautious about is that we have to realize that much of the changes, many of the changes, and much of what's taken place in this country did not take place because of malice or ill intent on the part of those people that were doing this. Instead, we find that farmers have been swept along in this country by technological advances that were thrust upon them. And so Ron asks, when we show this slideshow, to be very clear that the reason we look back, the reason that we look back is though that we're not condemned to make the same mistakes. Okay? And this, for me, represents a turning point in agriculture, a very hopeful turning point, and that's some of what the farmers that are here are going to tell some stories about. It's what Wes Jackson calls, we now need an agriculture based on ecology instead of science and technology. And we need to look back at nature as our adversary, or not as our adversary, but as our partner. And we need to begin to understand and begin to farm in nature's image. And so this slideshow is put together with a series of slides that will depict and show in fairly graphic form some of the changes that have taken place in American agriculture. And it's the time after the war was ripe for change. It was ripe for change. We had a church view at the time, and maybe still do, that our God lives upstairs. And that man, as it says in the early chapters of Genesis, has dominion over nature. We have had an agriculture which has been built over two centuries on displacing indigenous peoples, and which has been built upon slavery in many parts of the country. As Wes Jackson says, it's an agriculture that's been based upon a European model, tried to adapt to the American landscape without regard for the characteristics of the land and the characteristics of the people of this landscape. And probably one of the most sweeping changes and one of the most sweeping influences in American agriculture has been capitalism. Capitalism, with its honoring of competition over cooperation, has pitted farmer against farmer, has pitted farmer against consumer, and corporate control and government has benefited along the way. And so after World War II, we found that many reasons have contributed to the changes in American agriculture. We won a sweeping victory in World War II. And as Henry Luce, the publisher of Time, Life, and Fortune magazines, quite arguably the most influential editor in possibly this century, said in an article, "This is the American century. It is our manifest destiny to lead the world as we led the world in World War II. We were victorious. And our victory was based in part upon technology. Technology such as the A-bomb, advances in weaponry such as nerve gas, aircraft used widely during the war was still available to us. Advances in medicine, pesticides such as DDT and 2,4-D and parathion all came about through war research. So we found ourselves with a victory. We found ourselves with a technology. In the case of aviation, we found ourselves with eager pilots and extra planes. And we began a war on the land, a war where we set out to eradicate bugs. And bugs were vilified, and the war continued against the land. And this war was placed, took about through propagandizing. And as George Orwell said in the classic movie, which escapes me right now.
1984.
The revolution will be complete when the language is perfect. And so we find ourselves, as Hiram Johnson also said, that truth is always the first casualty in the time of war. We've been sold a bill of goods, and farmers were the first to find themselves the target of sophisticated advertising campaigns following World War II. We also found at the end of World War II an American population that began to be quite influenced and hardened by the events of World War II. The US population spoke out quite strongly about the bombing of Dresden early on, the bombings of Rotterdam and Dresden. However, when the atomic bomb was used on Japan and when it was sold to us that this was the only way to bring about the end to that conflict, the American people found themselves hardened of heart. And so how can we expect the American people to return to the American landscape ready to find themselves in harmony with nature when this brutalization had been such a part of their psyche and such a part of their approach to life over the previous 4 years? Henry Luce also declared at the end of World War II that it was time to reduce the number of farmers in this country. And so over the course of the 1950s, 3.8 million farmers were to leave the land in that one decade alone. And they were to leave the land to work in industry and to fuel the industrial machine, which was to provide us with the consumer, the consumerism of which we are now a part. The Cold War was also a big part of the changes in American agriculture. At the end of World War II, the war never ended. Our mobilization and our readiness was still a big part of this country. Industries such as the Jayhawk Ordnance Works were sold in the late 1940s to the Spencer Chemical Company of Kansas City, Kansas. And an ordnance company, which was at the time producing gunpowder and explosives, found itself producing fertilizers. The technologies that were used in the war, the airplanes, the gunpowder, the jeeps, all of these things, now we found ourselves once again with a fear of depression. And we wanted to keep that industrial machine alive and going. And so we found a rapid conversion from wartime production, producing at the time things directly for the conflict, modifying some of those things, and marketing them and selling them for domestic applications. Farmers, as well as the rest of society, had lived without for much of the war and the depression prior to this. And so people were ripe. People were ready for these things. Farm equipment was wearing out. People were ready for change. And so World War II, with its successes and with its victories, also became the beginning of a century, a half a century of change in American agriculture. And that's what the slideshow is about. If you could turn on the projector, and then someone could help me with the lights. As I mentioned, one of the things that's happened in this country is that the farm population has decreased and continues to decrease. In the 1980s alone, we lost 600,000 farms here in the United States. But as you can see, looking at the time immediately following World War II, that we still had a fairly vibrant farm population. And one of the things that began to happen is that when the new technologies were available, we needed more land available to apply those new technologies. The power through mechanical means that was available to us, the large-scale equipment, the pesticides, the herbicides, the aerial spraying could not be done on the scale of a diversified 120-acre family farm, 160-acre family farm. So we see farm size increasing as the number of farms decreases. Now, during World War II, approximately 16 million young men in this country received draft exemptions. They received draft exemptions because there were farm exemptions. And yet, many of those young men found themselves working on farms being accused of being cowardly and finding other means to escape the conflict. And so an ad campaign appeared in the early part of the war, and incidentally, most of the slides that you'll see are from the Farm Journal, which in 1956 had 3.5 million subscriptions. So it was at the time when we had about 3.5 million farms. So this was a widely circulated periodical throughout this country. So in the early part of the war, we start telling young men, you're part of the conflict. You're helping us out. The battle isn't only being fought on European soils and on Japanese soils. The battle is being fought in Kansas and in Minnesota and in Ohio on farm fields. So we find ads where young men are found approaching agriculture in a rather militaristic way. Food also began to become, not only during the war, but also after the war, a means of conflict. The late Senator Hubert Humphrey from Minnesota was one of the first to advocate food being used as a weapon to control countries. And so we find farmers being convinced that the food that they're producing is indeed part of the war. Here we have the young man being approached by the field sergeant, being told that the conflict at home is just as worthy as the conflict in Europe. It's interesting to find out who's putting out these ads too. GM Truck and Coach Division. Okay. It's all set to make sense. Food fight for freedom. Soldier of the soil. Farmers become the soldiers of the land. And this leads to the beginning of a change in the psyche of the farmer to begin to change the way they looked at their own land. Quaker Motor Oil. Now, after the war, we found ourselves, as I mentioned, farmers began to become the subject of much of the campaign to convert the wartime industrial capabilities to domestic uses. And so the farmer was told quite quickly, the war isn't over. The war is just beginning for the American farmer. And this war psyche, presented here by Phillips Motor Oil. We also found ourselves with an excessive abundance of the things that were produced during the time of the war. And because of this fear of falling back into the Depression, we kept many of those plants open, and some of that, some of those plants certainly are still in business today, producing things because of some of the fear of unemployment and providing people with a means of income. So the U.S. government took many of the things that were used in the conflict, surplus jeeps, some of which were still on the production line, many of which were still on the production line at the end of the war, and they approached the American farmer. They attempted to sell things like bulldozers and bridges, and one of the things that we'll talk about a little later in the slideshow, World War II began to see the sophistication of spraying equipment. You can see in the lower right corner a fogger, and also just above that, the chainsaw, which was developed in World War II and now is widely used. How many of you have seen Jeeps out in the field at neighboring farms? Okay. Farmers were convinced that this equipment was available cheap and that it could satisfy their needs. But it also really sets up the connection between the war and now the war on the land. The Jeep was one of those things in particular that was so widely available and so widely used during the war that they had to be distributed somewhere. And so many farmers were convinced to purchase them, and I'm not certain what the purchase price was at the time. So these ads were put together in 1947 and 48, showing the agricultural applications of the Jeep. We have a field day on top. I love the one on the bottom, the lower right corner, herding cattle, you know, bringing the milk cows in with the Jeep.
Are those still available today?
I don't know if they're still available, but I'll tell you what is available. These large Jeeps that were used in the Gulf War.
Humvees.
That they're starting to sell at, what, $30,000 a piece or something?
40.
40? Once again, at the bottom, a picture of a fogger on the back of a Jeep. A close-up of that shot. Bug-killing news. Publication that started immediately after the war. And it's interesting to see just underneath there, 666 may rival DDT. This chemical, lindane, came out as was used in the war, and its chemical compound, chemists referred to it as the 666, which doesn't need much further. Once again, the Jeep. Here we've got the farm wife down below in the Jeep, riding out to the field, unloading milk. Back to this conversion effort, we found that most of the factories that were producing consumer goods before the war converted to the war effort. And maybe some of you in the room that are old enough to remember some of the scarcity and some of the contributions that the American people were required to make during that time can add further light to this. But here is a cartoon. Airplanes and aerial spraying. Here we have the young man out flagging the plane down without a shirt or any kind of protective wear. And the correlation between a strafing mission and our approach to bugs. We had such an abundance of airplanes and such an abundance of pilots at the same time when farmers when the number of farmers and farms were disappearing in this country, that it was a match that was easily made. These are real ads. Okay, this is 1950, and DDT, which was used widely throughout the war, began to be used for domestic purposes. And let me mention this guy's, Ron wanted me to mention this guy's name. Ezra Krauss, scientist who was partly responsible for developing EDT in response to public skepticism about the pesticide, said that for 3 weeks, three times a day, he would take three teaspoons of DDT. Okay? Now, I'm not sure where this Ezra Krauss is and what came at the end of his life, but this shows you the great lengths that were taken to sell this campaign to the American people, not only to farmers here. Okay? Are you ready to fight the bug? And look at the bug, you know, on a motorcycle and riding the helmet. Cry aside. Okay. It was widely believed by the people that were manufacturing and marketing these things that we could completely annihilate certain insects. That we would see the complete destruction of certain species. The thing that was interesting is that DDT, the common house fly, was showing signs of resistance to DDT 2 years after it was marketed in this country. And the interesting thing, and something to mention to American, the proponents of American agriculture, is that pesticides are more common and there's a wider loss of crops to insect infestation than there was prior to the war. Weeds are reaping your profits. Fight these. All these war images.
Jeez.
Okay. This might seem quite comical, but the Pentagon was asked to put together a report on conversion from military uses with some of the technologies to domestic uses. And the atomic bomb was suggested as that it had some applications for agriculture. Okay? There was a report that came out of the Pentagon that suggested that we use the atomic bomb to open up the Colorado River watershed and to begin to farming more widespread in the deserts of Arizona and Southern California, and that it could be used quite easily for excavation. This is some of what came out of this. But also, this idea of power. We also began to find from the Food and Drug Administration, from the USDA, from American universities, that pesticides were now absolutely necessary. Okay. These were things that diversified small-scale farmers had not been using up until the time of the war, and by the mid-1950s, we began finding report after report that said that pesticides were absolutely necessary. In 1940, in this country, we had $50 million in pesticide sales. In 1980, I think that might be the next slide. In 1987, we had $1.5 billion in pesticide sales. And these are not for only agricultural purposes. Lawns, golf courses, public parks, schools, anhydrous ammonia became widely used as a quick-release nitrogen source for conventional farmers. And for those of you that are from the Midwest, you can see the anhydrous tanks being pulled behind the chisel plows or moldboard plows this time of year, and also in the spring. Interesting to note that anhydrous ammonia was used in the war to harden the ground. And it was applied to the soil in parts of Europe to set up airstrips. And it, although it does provide some quick-release nitrogen, it also kills just about everything else in the soil. And that's what we're using for fertility primarily in this country today. Number of farms decreased as the amount of fertilizer increased. Some of this responsible in part to the increased yields that have resulted throughout the what's called the Green Revolution of the 1950s and 60s. Penicillin at work on the farm, used primarily by field medics dealing with injured throughout the war, began to be used as a growth stimulant and hormone in almost all forms of animal production on farms.
Is that okay. Still used? Yeah?
Still used. Still used. Mm-hmm. Okay. This became one of those changes in psyche, is that farmers were told that their farms were a lot like factories, okay? And this is where we've lost. Wendell Berry says that the word agriculture is that the culture is as important in the word as agri, okay? And what we've lost here is that everything has been reduced to a production unit. Capitalism has been largely responsible for that. Our 1,200-acre corn factory, by the family's Golden Harvest family seeds. Average farm size in some southern Minnesota counties, 1,500 acres. This farm is a factory. What they've probably done is they've probably reduced their diversification, and in this case they've gone to hatchery and feed mills, most likely poultry. Along with the technologies and the equipment, we found that farmers were convinced that they could do things so much faster. And I've had so many organic farmers say at conferences and tell me directly that one of the things they enjoy the most about organic farming and sustainable farming is it returns some of the joy to agriculture. And this speed and efficiency is something that is still a slippery slope for most farmers. Can you feed 300 cattle in 20 minutes? Prior to World War II, this farmer probably had 30 or 40 head. 10 to 40 acres. 6 times faster than what we know. Interesting, in this photo is the, it'll come up later in the slideshow, no protection on this farmer at all. Okay? This boy can kill 20 million weeds in an hour. Okay?
That's what I mean.
Agricultural chemicals. And this was one of the things back to the anhydrous thing, is we began along with this understanding of quickness, we began to take shortcuts in agriculture. Profit margins are less, and so we need larger acreages. So now we start the campaign for marketing pesticides in this country. This is vintage 1970s. Monsanto, which is one of the largest chemical companies in the country. The Marksman. Lasso. This is an interesting one with this whole crime, images of crime, law and order. Okay. One of the changes in agriculture in this country is something called no-till, and we'll talk maybe a little bit more about that tomorrow. Soil erosion has historically been a problem in this country, and so a method of not disturbing the soil surface as little as possible is currently being advocated by university researchers and the government. And however, that system is built entirely upon chemicals. The Western theme. The stampede, stamp out those weeds. One of the things that happened as a result of using agricultural chemicals was the yields increased significantly. And the story that I tell about some of my own farming experience is the Hmong people that are currently farming. We have about 30,000 Hmong people in and around the Twin Cities where we farm. Those people had not used any chemicals before they came to this country. And they were taken out to the agricultural experiment station, and they were given a firsthand demonstration of spraying weeds with herbicides. And it really must have been miraculous. There must have been the perception that this really is a miracle. Okay. One of the other things that began to happen was the betrayal of the land grant system in this country. The Morrill Act set out in 1890 to make sure that the public had a research institution that informed the people, informed agriculture of farming, of better ways to farm. And I have some interest and connection to this because my father's an agronomist and involved in the Cooperative Extension Service. And although he has not received bonuses from chemical companies, many of his counterparts have. And there's a relationship, a hand-in-hand relationship between our own land-grant universities and the widespread use of chemicals in this country. Okay. More weapons for your war with weeds. The war continues. We saw a billboard as we were driving through western Montana just 2 days ago that said, "Help Montana win the war against weeds." New weapons, more sophisticated methods of spraying. Rambo. Look in the Top Gun. Win that war with javelin. Force. All of these militaristic images. The 1980s, we began to see more of this with the advent of the Reagan years and increased militarization in this country. Ambush. This is an older one from the 50s. The squad leader. Eradicate those weeds entirely. It can be done with chemicals. Revenge. Some serious grass. And the images continue. Get rid of those copper or shotguns. One-handed. One of the things that happened in the 1980s is that chemical companies began to seriously alter the chemical composition of agricultural chemicals. And this is an advertisement for mixing chemicals together, which is commonly used in this country today. And one of the things that happens is that when you combine chemicals, there is the likelihood that you are altering the chemical nature of those chemicals, and you're also altering the ability to detect those chemicals. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture, which is required for providing a certain percentage of spot inspections on commodities sold in the state, said of 650 registered chemicals, they were only able to detect residues of 90. That they don't have the sophistication to even tell if that's on our food. Once again, the relationship between soil conservation and the use of chemicals promoted here by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. If you're going to be a good steward of the soil and protect your land, then you have to use chemicals. When chemicals were first introduced, there was also very little regard to protection from those chemicals. We saw the picture earlier on the farm wall M. Here's a young man mixing stuff up that looks like it's going to be added to some kind of irrigation. He does have a respirator, an aspirator. Oh, I guess that's the end of that tree. Find ourselves successful Farm to Magazine of the late 1970s, then convincing farmers that they really do, for their own protection, they really do need to be to have some protection from the use of those agricultural chemicals. Oops, might not be all the way down there. I flipped it back.
What happens when we place our faith in technology?
That's right. However, we still see ads. This is a fairly recent ad here of the farmer pouring chemicals without any protective wear at all. And so the chemical companies continue to deny that any harmful effects. However, Successful Farming Magazine, I'm not sure when this was done. Some studies are also being done right now at the University of Minnesota to trace exposure on farmers. Groundwater contamination is a serious problem in this country, and certainly I think more so a problem in parts of the Midwest where well levels are only in some cases 30 to 40 feet. In some Midwestern and some Minnesota, southern Minnesota counties, 40% of the wells are contaminated, primarily with atrazine, which has been, through legislative action, been heavily regulated and really taken off the market in Wisconsin. And Minnesota is about to take suit with that. So now we find ourselves in the 1990s. And the marketing of agricultural chemicals takes on a more sophisticated, as George Orwell said, a language is what will make it complete. And so we find a more sophisticated campaign. This is so ironic, using the name of an indigenous people of North America to sell toxins. But the gentle, you know, the gentleness of the name and of the photo. Siva Geigy, one of the largest chemical companies in the country here, using a little emotional appeal. This is an advertisement for agricultural chemicals. Accent. And once again, some of the denial, and one of the problems that we have as organic farmers in this country is that the research really is stacked against us. USDA, in conjunction with American universities and chemical companies, can really defend whatever. So here they are attempting to convince us that you can die of many other things before you're going to be harmed by chemicals. And this one is really quite interesting. Now more than ever, the environment is right for salmon. Okay? It doesn't say that salmon is protecting the environment. It says that your farm is right. The time is now for salmon. And look at the pastoral images here used. Okay. Another thing that's happened in the past 10 years is that the potency of agricultural chemicals has increased in some cases 100-fold. And that now where farmers were using a barrel or a 5-gallon drum, they're now using very small quantities. And so chemical companies are packing more punch in smaller concentrations. Okay. Some farmers are having to go through some, here they're trying to convince us that they've gone through some professional application courses. Okay. Another troubling thing that's happened in this country and throughout the world is that chemical companies, who are incidentally owned to a large degree by petroleum companies, are now purchasing seed companies. And about 70% of the seed in this country is controlled by chemical companies. Okay, so we've set up a conflict of interest here where we have such tight vertical integration where the farmers are literally subject to one company for all of their inputs on their farm. Seed, the chemicals. And finally here, I think we can, there's still this feeling that we can win this war. That we can eradicate these insects entirely, and yet we find more and more insects resistant, and as going back to the eyedropper earlier, we're finding that we're having to use larger and larger amounts of toxins to knock down insects because of their resilience to some of this stuff. And so we're still trying to be convinced that the war is winnable. The Gulf War, having its influences on American agriculture. 15 new stealth hybrids. The military images continue. Norman Schwarzkopf making a field visit here with guardsmen. This came out right after the Gulf War. Okay, I guess that's the end of the end of the show. Okay. Yeah, I'm gonna get some. Somebody wanna hit the lights? So, what are some reactions?
I think if a guy didn't have a newspaper or TV or a magazine he's reading, didn't pay attention to his neighbor, he might be still doing it the way his father did it.
Some of what's happening
in... You let that come at you and influence you, you're gobbled up in the movement.
You know, one of the things...
When I'm speaking for myself, when I first started farming, I was trained, I did my apprenticeship with a conventional or chemical orchardist, and he told me when I bought my land that I wouldn't last 2 years growing organically. You'd be spraying just like the rest of the town.
My prayer has been for a revolution amongst the farmers, because I'm the daughter of a conventional farmer, and I go home on occasion and I hear about how my dad is and my older brother are certainly pawns in a game. Pawns in an agribusiness is what it is. And for one of my father's crops, there's a company in Southern California that tells him from Southern California when to harvest his crop. You know? Mm. And there's field.
What crop is it?
I can't, do you remember that crop? It's one of the seed crops,
okay.
For sure. And my mom, being a very reactionary person, she just is disgusted by all this. And she just says, I just can't believe that they're looking at their computers and they're looking at the market prices and, you know, they're seeing what they need and they're telling us when we can harvest and they don't know that it's raining up here and, you know, we've got other things, you know, that are needing to happen on the farm. And also, you know, that my dad is, he's at the mercy of fieldmen who are telling him when to spray and what to spray and, the aphid infestation is getting bad, so let's get the aerial sprays in here. So I think I cherish my time, my memories on this conventional farm that I grew up on, but I know it's not right, and I know my dad probably would be the first to admit that he's stuck, and my older brother feels like he is a warrior in the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the things that Ron tries to really caution people about is that what's needed here is a cultural change. Mm-hmm. And some of that is, you know, we look back to some of the early graphics and statistics about the number of people involved in agriculture, say at the turn of the century, and that peaked in about the 1920s in this country, to the point now where we have about 2 million, and in some of the 1990 census information has it right around 2 million, and I'll tell you, we now have 98% of the population in this country that is not directly involved in agriculture, okay. And the use of chemicals in urban and suburban lawns is applied at a rate of about 7 times what it is to agricultural land. And being an organic farmer, one of the things that we have to have is that, you know, we're required by law to have a barrier, a drift barrier. And the largest problem I have is chemical drift from lawn care services. And incidentally, one of the people that's partly responsible for some of this drift is a Lutheran pastor that lives right next to my farm. Okay? And the Lutheran Church, the synod of which I'm a member and of which I'm trying to do some work in, many of the suburban churches contract with chemical lawn care companies to just do broad applications of agricultural chemicals on church property. And I'm trying to start a resolution within our synod that would be completely discouraged, and we're trying to put together some alternative ways to discourage that. My caution was that because of the low food prices in this country, farmers are really up against the wall right now. And that's why the conversion from a conventional system where someone's telling you what seed to use, when to harvest, and all of that sort of stuff, to any kind of conversion to sustainability or to organics it's such a fine line that these people are carrying a debt load, and if their livelihood, it's so determined by a narrow profit margin. You know, we pay less for food than any country in the world, about 11% of our income, compared to Europe where they pay about 25%. You know, we have to get higher prices for food.
Just a couple of comments. As the daughter of a conventional farmer who was a crop and livestock farmer in the 50s and 60s and then sold and ran a chemical and fertilizer plant for the second 10 years, my father's response to sort of discussions and stuff about this now is that a lot of the, another element to just the militarism was also the fear that people had about ever having hunger again. And he, you know, really believed that the chemical industry was also driven a lot by we aren't going to be able to feed the world, and as a country that experienced, you know, a lot of depression, and I mean, there was a fear that we just would also experience hunger, and he maintains that a lot of that use of fertilizer was driven by the notion that we would not be able to feed the world unless we had these. And then a second comment would just be that as somebody who works in healthcare, I'm really struck by some of the advertisements being really similar. I know that a lot of the chemical plants are also owned by pharmaceutical companies, or they're jointly owned or whatever, and that much of the advertisement is also pushed towards the notion of how we should also have a similar relationship to our body as we have to the land, in terms of these chemicals can fix our health and also change our body. And so it's not only relationship to land, but also relationship to our bodies are somewhat similar. So.
This notion of feeding the world is still prevalent today. And yet, in 1988, the United States became a net importer of food, which is something most people don't realize. And grain elevators throughout the state of Minnesota say, you know, working together to feed the world, okay? And so there's still this perception that we are indeed the breadbasket of the world, and we are feeding the world, but we're actually importing more food than we're exporting right now.
I got a question on that. Is that a twofold answer? Is it because farm productivity is going down because of farming dead soils and fewer farmers? Is it our population growing and just fewer people growing and more people eating?
Well, I think you know, some of it may be related to the CRP program, where we took how many millions of acres of land out, fragile land out of production in this country. So I think the overall number of tillable acres probably reduced in the late 1800s, or the late 80s. But I think the overall yield has been about the same. So I don't know. I can't answer that. I'm sure it's an influence of both. So.
Well, two areas kind of increasing concern. Regarding pollution is not just the chemicals themselves, but it's the degradation products. Why those chemicals change once they get into the ground and the groundwater.
And they have a half-life.
And we know virtually nothing about this. We're just starting. And the other problem is that a lot of these chemicals, once they leave the field, adhere to the sediment. And so the sediment moves irregularly, and it can be immobilized and harmless as it goes past one place, but something that enters, another chemical that enters the water, releases that stuff from the sediment, and we've got a big problem again. So.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you're a hydrologist. Are you doing some actual well tests and?
No.
Okay.
Retired. But that's one of the problems. And it's gotten so bad that when people go to scientific meetings now, all the chemical companies have their representatives right there at the scientific meetings so that they can shout down, deny any results that says, well, here's the results that we found. And they don't question the techniques, though. I mean, they're right there.
Yeah.
They know who's doing the research, and they look at the meeting list, and if that fellow's name or woman's name is on the list, then they'll be there.
Other reactions?
Dan, when this was put together, I noticed that you were talking about since World War II. Are there some major companies that were some of the main ones that pushed this? This whole idea of chemicals and the war, the whole war.
Yeah, I mentioned
some Westinghouse. What were some of the main ones right after World War II?
Well, certainly some of the chemical companies, the largest chemical companies are DuPont and Monsanto, and the Sibagagi is probably one of the agricultural chemical companies. But one of the things that ended up happening is the consolidation of those companies, as I mentioned. You know, they began to purchase other companies, and really, you know, Beth just talked about it, where you know, it's now the situation where, say, in Minnesota, for example, the seeds are sold by that company, the chemical inputs are sold by that company, and in some cases, the equipment that harvests it and tills it is in part owned by some of those companies. You know, so it's a difficult situation.
And the fuel they buy power with doesn't
vary too. And interestingly enough, when we talk about efficiency in this country, one of the arguments that that sustainable or organic farmers use is kind of an accounting of calories of energy used to produce calories of food, and comparing that to other agricultural systems around the world, most notably the Chinese and other. More human scale and intensely human-powered agricultural systems have a much lower ratio of kilocalories of energy used to produce kilocalories of food. We're a tremendous waster of energy, agriculture is, compared to what our bodies are actually getting out of that.
Well, agriculture wastes a lot of water too. You know, and it takes so many hundreds of gallons to produce 1 pound of beef or.
Yeah. I 2 points. One is that that same system of militarization that went into agricultural farm products also went into animal raising and husbandry of poultry, mm-hmm. of pork production, of cattle production, and even milk. And it's just amazing. My brother works in a steel firm in the Midwest fabricating, and mostly what they do is they build confinement pens for pigs, and it's basically a pen that a pig stands up for in its entire life until it's killed. And you know, we have this image, I think, yet of our food and of our meat to come off of these fancy little family farms where the pigs are out running and rutting and the chickens are pecking in the dirt, and it's not happening. And I think that it's not going to take long, and I think it's already happening, where we're beginning to open our eyes up to the militarization and to the misuse of products and chemicals and growth hormones and all the other things that are going into our food system. So I think that's a pretty incredible kind of situation we've gotten ourselves into. And in the Northwest, and just because of the meat issue, has gotten to be a real big deal.
Food safety?
Food safety. We can't seem to get away without having an outbreak of, what is it?
E. coli
poisoning, and that whole issue that surrounds that. So I just hope that we can move back to a saner system at some point. Production.
Are we suggesting then the church play a major role in promoting and monitoring certain kinds of agricultural processes? Or is that, like, you know, can we get the churches to not put pesticides on their lawns, and then the mushrooms into the churches start regulating certain things? Is that something that you see that as a helpful thing, or?
Well, you've touched upon probably one of the most sensitive issues, and I don't know where you're from, but I don't know if you've worshipped in any small rural, probably by farmers and farm families. The form of agriculture from the pulpit is really directly judgmental of those very parishioners. And that's what makes this such a sensitive thing, is that the farmers are really stuck, okay? They're really stuck here, and that's that's part of that difficult dilemma, and that's why we need some kind of a cultural revolution, a cultural solution to this. We need what Wes Jackson calls more eyes to the acre. We need more people involved in agriculture in this country, you know. What you did mention, though, and what some of what I'm trying to work on with the church, the Lutheran Church, many local Lutheran churches, and the National Lutheran Church owns land. Lutheran College is owned land. St. Olaf College, Northfield, Minnesota, 900 acres of